So I don't really know what to make of this, but apparently we're the third class going through Jonah right now. I've been a theologian long enough that I don't believe in coincidence. I'm not really sure why we need to be going through Jonah as a church right now, but apparently we do. Couple of things I got to say before I begin working our way through it. I am indebted to Bob Chisholm at DTS for teaching me how to interpret the book linguistically. I mean, that man basically made me sentence diagram the whole book in Hebrew. It was a pain at the time, but I'm eternally grateful to him now. As far as historical and exegetical significance, this is a commentary called God's Scandalous Mercy by Kevin Youngblood. Outstanding resource. And then if you're looking for a really accessible book that pushes through the problematic nature of this story, Tim Keller has an excellent book called The Prodigal Prophet. And I cannot recommend that book highly enough. That book is fantastic on several levels. Jonah's a tough story. And I think as we go through it, you'll see that asking the question about whether or not he was actually swallowed by a great fish winds up literally and figuratively being one of the shallower questions that we can ask. This book is problematic because of the time in which it takes place and the events that were going around Israel at the time. So we're actually going to start in 2 Kings today instead of Jonah. We got to put this book in its historical context. So I'm going to be in 2 Kings 14. I'm going to start in verse 23. In the 15th year of the reign of Judah's king Amaziah, son of Joash, Jeroboam, son of Joash, became king over Israel. He reigned for 41 years in Samaria. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not repudiate the sinful ways of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who encouraged Israel to sin. He restored the border of Israel from Lebo Hamath in the north to the Sea of the Arabah in the south, in accordance with the word of the Lord God of Israel, who announced it through his servant Jonah, son of Amittai, the prophet who was from Gath-Hepher. And the Lord saw Israel's intense suffering. Everyone was weak and incapacitated, and Israel had no deliverer. The Lord had not decreed that he would blot out Israel's memory from under heaven, so he delivered them through Jeroboam, son of Joash. Now, thankfully, we can actually date when Jeroboam reigned. The further you get into the Old Testament, the easier it is and the more concrete it is to be able to date certain events. So we know that we're dealing with this time period, 786 BC to 746 BC. That is the time in which Jonah is ministering under Jeroboam. We also know what's happening in the Fertile Crescent at the time. So forgive me, I am a terrible map drawer, but bear with me. This is the western edge of the Mediterranean. Looks like it, doesn't it? Yeah. I'm terrible, I know. Okay. Sinai Peninsula, Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. And this is the Fertile Crescent. As history progresses, the empires that take over the Fertile Crescent and the empires that kind of move through one another, get further and further west as they go. And so if Assyria is kind of up here in modern day Iraq, Babylon is going to be down here, Persia is going to be down here, and they keep getting further away from our target area. Now, Assyria is kind of up here. Assyria took over from the, especially the Sumerians, kind of wiped out the tail end of the Mesopotamians, the Akkadians. Assyria was well known for violence. I mean, they were terrible people. Machiavelli cited the Assyrian Empire as one of his influences in terms of how to utilize brutality in terms of power. And so for Jonah, Assyria is the major power in the Fertile Crescent at the time. Unfortunately for Israel, and we see this play out as history marches forward. Anytime there's a new power that rises in the Fertile Crescent, they decide they want to go to war with Egypt down here because the only way to assert yourselves in the ancient world is to fight Egypt for some reason. And the only way to get to Egypt, boop, 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 is straight through Israel. So as Assyria was consolidating power in the early 700s BC, they were progressively marching further and further and further and further towards Israel, and had actually started attacking some northern outposts of the kingdom of Israel. Now remember, we're dealing with a divided kingdom at the time. So we've got Israel in the north, we've got Judah in the south. Assyria is starting to harass the northern kingdom of Israel, and then several things happen in quick succession in the mid-700s that force them to stop. The big one is a series of famines hit the Fertile Crescent. And we have exemplary records of this just from excavations of the ancient Assyrian Empire, and they talk about when these famines were hitting and how there was societal unrest. We actually have records of revolts happening in some major Assyrian cities throughout the empire, primarily because of the lack of food. And so Assyria is dealing with an internal division. They're also dealing with an external threat from a kingdom in the north. The Urartu kingdom has decided that because Assyria is dealing with a bunch of famine, they are going to start attacking the northern outposts of Syria. And so what winds up happening is Assyria, instead of continuing eastward in attacking the northern parts of Israel, they have to wind up defending their northern flank against the Urartu Empire, which means they're pulling military expeditions back, which is why Jeroboam winds up being able to recapture part of Israel's territory. I just did 50 years of ancient history in about 3 minutes. Everybody good? All right. Let's talk about Assyrian military strategy for a second. They were famous for relocation. And what Assyria would wind up doing when they came into a territory they conquered, they would literally disperse the people to various points of the empire so that rebellions could not form and rise up against them, right? You stick a lot of people who know each other, who share a language, who share a culture, they're more likely to rise up in rebellion. And so when Assyria would conquer a neighboring state, they would literally take all the people, move them and spread them out throughout the empire. They also were, and I mentioned this briefly, famous for their brutality. These are horrible people. There's an interesting historical record. I say interesting, it's atrocious. When they were attacking Damascus, before they relocated everybody from that area to various parts of the empire to prevent rebellion, they said they took all the women of one of the towns. Assyrian soldiers repeatedly raped them until they were pregnant with Assyrian babies and then relocated them. These are not good people. They were famous for beheading, putting heads on pikes. They were famous for flaying people alive. And I bring that up because when we're dealing with Nineveh and we're dealing with the king of Assyria, and we're going to be in part of the empire in chapter 3, we have to maintain a focus on who these people are. Now let's get to the problematic part of Jonah. Anybody know what happens in 722 BC? Anybody remember?
Israel falls to Assyria.
Right. Israel is going to be completely wiped out by the Assyrian Empire. Like, the reason we call it the Jewish religion, we call them Jews, is because Judah was the only portion of the kingdom that survived. Israel is gone. And Assyria is going to come in. They're not going to quite get to Jerusalem. Babylon's going to come in a few years later and finish that part off. But Assyria brutally wipes them out in 722. Which means, follow me here, Jonah is going to be called to go to Nineveh within two generations of Nineveh sending an army to annihilate Israel. That's a big problem. It's a big theological problem that we have to work our way through. And look, this is Grace Bible Church. I'm assuming that you've heard the story of Jonah once, twice, maybe 1,000 times. I'm assuming you've shown your kids the VeggieTales movie. I was in a musical for Jonah when I was a kid at the United Methodist Church in Crystal Lake, Illinois. One of the things that I'm going to do, I'm sorry, what? Yeah, that's the one. That's the one. I've never actually heard someone who knew the songs.
This is kind of like the end where we transition. We're going to have a mute. We're going to do the go-go journey. I don't know.
That's funny. Well, okay, we're wrapped up now. That's, yeah. Now that we've heard that, what more do we need? Okay. I'm not going to hold my punches on this, and I'm actually going to be jumping around Jonah because I want to try to discern Jonah's motivations. One of the more interesting facets of this book is we do see Jonah interacting with God, Jonah telling God what he thinks, Jonah kind of explaining, defending himself to God. And that's one of those things that I think is crucial for our understanding of this, because if I am reading the land correctly, if I'm understanding how this is working, I've got an empire that is repeatedly attacked, that has fallen back because of what looks like divine justice. Remember, how did the ancient world view famine? Justice. The divine is visiting people for something that they had done. By the way, this is why the king of Nineveh in chapter 3 is so quick to repent, so quick to order a fast. He seems to understand the divine justice portion of it. If I'm in Israel, do I think it's an accident that Assyria starts getting attacked from the north? Perhaps this is God beginning to deliver us from the violence of our oppressive neighbors, the people who want to enslave us, the people who want to conquer us. So I've got this empire that's in shambles, both internally and facing an existential threat from the outside in the Urartu Empire. That's the time period in which Jonah is called to go to Nineveh. And one last thing that I have to mention before we actually get into the text. Nineveh is not yet the capital of Assyria. Sennacherib is going to make Nineveh the capital of Assyria. Okay, so Nineveh, it would be the equivalent of, oh, I don't know, like a Chicago or a Los Angeles. Not the capital. Important. And its importance will only grow in the aftermath of what's going to happen in this book. Okay? Everybody good on the background? Let's look at the text. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai. Go immediately to Nineveh. Do you have great city? What's your translations doing here? Great, yeah.
It says large capital city.
Large capital city? You're dealing with the net? Uh-huh. And it's got a big ol'. My footnote is about 3/4 of a page long on that word. The word here is gadol. And it means great. And like the English word great, the word gadol can mean several things. It can mean important. It can mean large. It can mean significant, however you want to put that. Jonah is going to have a lot of play on words with this. Okay. So the word of the Lord comes to Jonah, son of Amittai, go immediately to Nineveh, the great city, and announce judgment against its people. Do you have evil, wickedness? What do you have? Wickedness. Okay. Because their wickedness... do you have, came up before me, came to my attention? What do you have?
Came to my attention.
Came to my attention. Okay. This word is ra'ah. And ra'ah in the ancient world meant several forms of evil. And we're going to see that play out in the story of Jonah. Whoever wrote this book, and I'll provide some insight into that in a few weeks, seemed to love a good play on words. The word evil in Hebrew can mean quite literally the things that I do to somebody else that are not good, but it can also mean natural disaster or calamity, right? Evil befell somebody because of a storm, because of, oh, I don't know, a storm on a sea with a great ferocious wind, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody with me? So we've got two words that are going to be repeated throughout chapter 1. That I want to pay attention to. But we're going to spend our time in verse 3. So Jonah got up, immediately went to Tarshish. Do you have to flee from the presence of the Lord? Yeah. Yeah.
One says to escape from the commission of the Lord.
The good old net. That's what I'm using too. It's quite literally, the word is barach, and it means to flee in the opposite direction from the presence. This particular construction is only used one other time in the Old Testament. It's used in the story of Exodus. Follow me here. Moses is not a good guy. He kills a man. You remember the story? So Moses goes out to watch his people, and he winds up seeing an Egyptian taskmaster brutally beating a couple of Hebrew slaves. And so Moses kills him. And I love the way the text describes his next step, looking this way and that, realizing that no one had seen what he had done. He buried the body in the sand. So the next day he goes back out and he sees two Hebrew slaves fighting. And he says, hey, why are you fighting your brother? And the first one looks at Moses and goes, what, are you going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday? And the text says Moses realized everyone knew what he had done. I suppose there's some kind of theological lesson in there about when we bury sin with our own hands, it tends to come back to haunt us. But for our purposes, Moses flees from before the presence of Pharaoh. That's where this construction gets used. Now, Moses is down here, and he flees to a place called Midian, which is in modern-day Saudi Arabia. He's fleeing from the presence of Pharaoh. The way that we might word this is he's trying to get out of Pharaoh's jurisdiction. If the punishment for murder is the death penalty, the only way to survive is to get out of the area that Pharaoh controls. That seems to be what Jonah is attempting to do, fleeing from before the presence of the Lord. He wants to go to Tarshish. Now look, if Nineveh is up here, famously we don't know where Tarshish is. Okay? I've always found the most compelling argument is that it's in Spain. Regardless, it is somewhere west in the Mediterranean. And so God asked Jonah to go to Nineveh. What method would I travel to get from here to here? Be going over land, yes? Instead, Jonah, in his attempt to flee, is going to go by boat. All right? Watch how the text puts this. He traveled to Joppa, found a merchant ship heading to Tarshish. He paid the fare and went aboard to go with them to Tarshish as far away from the Lord as he could. So I've got a commission, travel by land, go to this famous city. I'm going to go down to Joppa. I'm going to go down to the dock. I'm going to go down to the boat, and I'm going to escape on sea. The word to go down is yarad. Help me out. In the ancient world, where were the gods? Up. Jonah, in an attempt to flee from the presence of the Lord, is going to go down. And the text could not make this clear, right? I'm fleeing from him physically, geographically. I'm going in the opposite direction. You want me to go this way? I'm going this way. You want me to go by land? I'm going to go by sea. And oh, by the way, I'm just going to keep on going down to make a point. Now, God tends to use that to his advantage in chapter 2, right? Oh, you want to go down? Okay, we'll go all the way down. And then once I've got your attention, maybe we can have a little bit of a chat. But for our purposes in chapter 1, Jonah is fleeing from God physically. He's fleeing from God spiritually. He's fleeing from God emotionally. He's trying to get as far away from God as he can go. The only catch to this is Jonah knows he can't. And you're going to see that play out in chapter 1. And so Jonah is working his way. How do I want to put this? Jonah's trying to make a point by his actions in chapter 1. So the Lord hurled a powerful wind on the sea, and such a violent tempest arose on that sea that the ship threatened to break up. The sailors were so afraid that they each cried out to his own God. They flung the ship's cargo overboard to make the ship lighter. Jonah, meanwhile, had gone down into the hold of the ship, had lain down and was sound asleep. Okay, setting aside another famous guy who goes to sleep in a storm on a boat where a bunch of sailors are terrified of what's going to happen to them, how powerful does this storm have to be for professional sailors to be scared? Yes? I mean, this is a terrifying event for them. How on earth is Jonah asleep? I mean, if this is a storm that's bad enough that the ship is rocking back and forth, that the sailors who own the ship, who are working on the ship, are scared that the ship is going to break apart to the point that they're flinging cargo overboard. How on earth is Jonah just casually taking a nap?
Because he's a male.
She said because he's a man. Well, so far, do we see any indication that he might be depressed?
No.
We see a very methodical decision-making process, right? How can he be asleep?
Seared conscious. I don't know. I mean, I am being serious. How do you, I mean, we know lots of things. It's not just an animal. You look in the mirror and you don't see something and you're just, for whatever reason, you're good with it. I could truly see somebody going down and sleeping and not thinking anything about it, because when he's in a deep sleep, which he obviously had to be for him to wake him up through that storm, when you sleep, you don't have to think.
Correct. Keep going.
So we haven't gotten the answer yet.
He's a prophet.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. There's a level of confidence. Yeah. Yeah.
Two wild guesses. One, terribly depressed. Four, terribly drunk.
Drunk?
Yeah, I would like to
go. Certainly plausible.
Could he have just been mentally exhausted because he's been wrestling with God?
But do we see him wrestling with God?
No, we don't.
Yeah, he just gets up and goes, right?
But isn't depression, anger internalized, and isn't he angry with God?
And we'll see that in chapter 4. He's mad at God.
God is asking him to do something he didn't want to do, so he's already pretty ticked.
Oh, I think so. And anger can give you a sense of self-righteous confidence, can it not? Yes. Yeah, when they wake him up, it's going to be pretty clear.
Yes, because if you know what you're doing,
it's just sound asleep.
Yeah, that's true.
Sound asleep,
not
just asleep.
And we know he's not a college
student. Right. Well said.
Probably not a teenager.
Well said. Huh. So I've got a guy who's fleeing from God, who doesn't seem to be scared. Everybody with me? And I think the one thing that I can clearly conclude, he's not scared of what he's doing, and he doesn't feel ashamed of what he's doing. Right? When I do something terrible, I put my foot in the mouth, I hurt somebody bad, I screw up in some major way, I typically can't sleep at night. Because I just keep playing the scene over and over in my head, right? Y'all are just like me. We do the same thing. We play the scene over and over and over again. And each time we get to the point where we make a mistake, we're like begging our past selves, don't do it, don't say it, don't do it. And then you're up all night, right? Not him. And so I've got a guy fleeing from the presence of the Lord, which we know you can't do. Jonah, by the way, knows too. He just doesn't care. He seems to have some kind of issue, some kind of, and we know from chapter 4 it's anger, it's frustration. But it leads to this self-righteous confidence that enables him to peacefully sleep during a hurricane that's so severe that everybody on the ship thinks they're going to die. I mean, they're literally flinging the cargo overboard, which means they're not getting paid for this journey. If you're scared enough that you're dumping your income over the side, a guy from Gath Hepher should not be sound asleep in the cargo hold. And yet there he is. So there seems to be a level of assuredness in Jonah. At the very least, he's comfortable enough with what he's doing to go to sleep.
But if he also knows God as well as he seems to, then he, not just confident in himself and his actions, he knows God's going to do what God's going to do.
We'll see.
But does he think that God is mistaken this time?
Yeah, and I hate to spoil chapter 4. Yeah, he thinks God's wrong. He thinks God is in the wrong. And to spoil it for a month from now, he might have a point. I'm going to start laying out a defense of Jonah's actions. I mean, Jonah is literally going to go to a city. God is going to forgive a bunch of people so they can annihilate his chosen people. Jonah might have a point. And I'm not suggesting that Jonah is in the right and God is in the wrong, but I do think we can start to understand the motivation of what Jonah is trying to do. Assyria is on the ropes. If Jonah does not go to Nineveh, does not preach against the violence, Nineveh does not ask for forgiveness, maybe they don't annihilate Israel. I mean, there's a very clear motivation for why Jonah does not want them forgiven. By the way, to spoil a little bit more of chapter 4, he's so sure that God is going to change his mind on forgiveness that he sets up a shelter outside the city to watch Sodom and Gomorrah-style fire rain from heaven and annihilate everybody in Nineveh. That's how confident Jonah is that God is going to see the error of his ways. This is a man running who thinks he's in the right. Watch how extreme he goes, though, in chapter 1. I've got 5 minutes. I can speed ahead a little bit, and then we'll come back to a portion of chapter 1. What does Jonah tell the sailors to do? Throw him overboard. Why? By the way, remember, hurricane, middle of the Mediterranean. What is Jonah anticipating is going to happen? Nowhere in Jonah's speech does he say, if you throw me overboard, God is going to provide a giant fish that will come up and swallow me and take me where I know. Why does Jonah want to get thrown overboard? Bingo. Because if I die, the message dies with me. Right, there is nothing in Jonah's character, there is nothing in any other scripture to suggest that Jonah had any indication that God is going to calm this storm and provide a fish that's going to swallow him and take him off. Jonah is so confident in what he's doing that he looks at those sailors and says, hey, just throw me overboard. Just let me die. It'll be all right. Whew. I'll read one more or two more verses. I'll call it for a day. So the ship's captain, I'm in verse 6, by the way. My apologies, I feel very scattered. The weather is just messing with my sinuses in ways that I was not anticipating. I cannot win this spring. So the ship's captain approached Jonah and said, what are you doing? Get up, cry out to your God. Perhaps your God might take notice of us so that we might not die. And the sailors said to each other, come on, let's cast lots to find out whose fault it is that this, by the way, do you have disaster, calamity? What do you have? This Ra'ah has overtaken us. So they cast lots. Jonah was singled out. And they said to him, tell us, whose fault is it that this evil has overtaken us? What's your occupation? Where do you come from? What's your country? Who are your people? Verse 9 is kind of the linchpin to chapter 1 to show us that Jonah is confident in what he's doing and does not care about fleeing from God. Look at this. I am a Hebrew, and I worship Yahweh, the God of heaven, who is over the sea and the dry land. He knows he can't flee from the presence of Yahweh, and yet here we are, fleeing from the presence of Yahweh. That is a confident man who can, out of one corner of his mouth, say, yeah, not going to go to Nineveh. Out of the other corner of his mouth, yeah, I know I can't flee from him because he made the sea and the dry land, but I'm running anyway. And there's something to be said for that level of confidence. Right? I mean, the sailors are panicked, and you hear it in the rapid-fire question, right? Who are you? What do you do? Who's your God? Like, tell us what to do, because we're freaking out. Right? We're going to die. Call out to your God in the same way that we're calling out to all of our gods. Jonah just kind of casually drops this, I serve the God of gods. God who made the sea and the dry land.
So in verse 6, when he says that, because I've wondered this, the sailors don't really know that his God is Yahweh.
Correct.
They all just have gods, and so they're just saying, you do what we're doing, and maybe your God will...
Correct. Okay. Correct. By the way, we'll see the sailors' response in a minute. It's profound. One last thing I want to point out. In verse 6, and forgive me for not pointing this out when I did it, do you have the ship's captain comes to him and says the exact same thing that God said to him in verse 2? Do you have get up, cry out? Yeah, you should have the exact same thing that God calls him to do in verse 2. God says, get up, go cry out, go call against. That word is kara. It means to preach, to call out, to cry out. God says, get up, call out. Ship's captain says, get up and call out. And Jonah gets up. But in both cases, he's not going to call out to the thing or call out in the way that he's supposed to. He's not going to go to Nineveh and call out against their Gadol Ra'ah. He's in the ship, not going to call out to God and ask for forgiveness. Oh, no, no, no. We're not going to ask for that. We're going to say, throw me overboard. We're going to get a little stubborn in our confidence. But again, and this is where I want to leave us for the week. If I am Jonah, and for most of my life, I've heard reports about Assyrian brutality. For most of my life, I know that Assyria has been attacking the northernmost outposts of my country. I know, I can read the tea leaves. I know they are going to go to war with Egypt, and my puny little country is in the way. If I'm Jonah, and I hear that all of a sudden, maybe there's some hope that this empire is going to fall apart. There's some internal dissent. There's some revolt. There's some famine. There's another empire who's attacking them. If I'm Jonah, maybe I want to accelerate this process. Maybe I want to make sure that divine justice continues to be visited on a truly horrific, barbaric empire. If I'm Jonah, plausibly, And I want to make this clear. This is not said in the text, but plausibly, maybe I can save my people by not saving theirs. And I'll say this, and it's a heck of a motivation. And that's the kind of motivation that would bring confidence. Again, not in the text. But if I'm searching for a motivation that Jonah is going to hold in his heart to give him enough confidence that he says, I'm going to sleep in a hurricane, enough confidence to say, I'd rather, like he's literally going to say this in chapter 4, I'd rather die than live in a world where Assyria is forgiven. So throw me overboard in the hurricane. That's a heck of a motivation. If I don't save them, perhaps I can save us. Okay? Next week, We'll go a little bit further into chapter 1. We'll try to discern a little bit more of what Jonah's after, why he's after it, and how the sailors on board that ship respond. Okay? Any questions? All right, thank you for bearing with me. I know that was a lot of information that I dumped on you. But, yeah, I think it helps because I cannot understand the theology of the book until I try to understand what Jonah's attempting to do. Okay? Let me pray first. We'll call it a day. Father, too often I see myself in Jonah, too often I see myself as knowing better than you, as thinking I'm more right than you. Forgive me for those moments. Forgive us for those moments. And Father, I pray that as we work our way through Jonah, I pray that our class, the two other classes going through it, we would encounter you. We would see you. We would understand you a little bit more. And perhaps have the courage to see how deep your grace and your forgiveness and your mercy actually goes. I pray this week that we would be molded by you, shaped by you, that you would continue to craft in us a desire to live for you. I pray that you would bring us back together next Sunday, excited once again to gather as a body to worship, to learn. I pray that you would continue to speak to us, and I pray this in your Son's magnificent name. Amen. All right.